Good afternoon, and welcome to Sound Living this afternoon. I'm Ed Bremmer, and my guest is stuck in traffic, but he will be joining us here briefly on this afternoon's Sound Living program. I'm Ed Bremmer. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. And my guest, when he arrives this afternoon, will be Jeff Siddiqui, a Pakistani-American living in Linwood. He is also a Muslim. Mr. Siddiqui has experienced firsthand the hatred, the fear, and the distrust Muslims live with in a post-9/11 America and indeed a post-9/11 world, including being confronted by passengers on an airplane because they felt he was too long in the bathroom. But rather than be silent and avoid calling attention to himself, he is outspoken and upfront about the prejudices and mistreatments aimed at Muslims. He blogs, he speaks out, he organizes rallies, he is very public in his efforts to combat anti-Muslim feelings in this country. His blog, if you'd like to read it, is at penjihad.wordpress.com. That is penjihad.wordpress.com. That is his blog, and if you would like to read his blog in anticipation of Mr. Siddiqui's arrival here on Sound Living this afternoon, you are certainly welcome to do that, and you will be encouraged to join the conversation this afternoon on KSER. Again, my guest, Jeff Siddiqui, is in transit. He's held up in traffic in coming up from Linwood this afternoon. We'll talk a little bit about Mr. Siddiqui, an American Muslim living in Linwood, Washington. He grew up in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan, and he continues to maintain close contacts in his native land. He is a member of the American Muslims of Puget Sound and is a human rights activist. He is involved with movements for interfaith understanding, has contributed articles for a textbook on terrorism used by U.S. law enforcement agencies. He has also presented discussions and written articles on the Indo-Pakistani hostilities and their impact on Afghanistan. He writes articles and gives lectures on civil rights, American foreign policy, on Islam, on current affairs, including events in the Middle East, South, and Central Asia. His works have been published in many journals, and he also does commentary on radio and television. Jeff Siddiqui is my guest on Sound Living this afternoon. He's caught in traffic coming up from Linwood, and we will be having him be our guest as soon as he arrives. But again, if you'd like to find out a little bit more about him, you can check out his blog. It is at penjihad.wordpress.com. It is penjihad.wordpress.com. And again, just as soon as he arrives on his transit up from Linwood this afternoon, traffic is very bad out on the freeway this afternoon, and we will be joined by Jeff Siddiqui. You might remember that just a few months ago, there was a rally that was up at the Peace Arch in Blaine, right at the border with Canada and the United States. That particular Muslim rally at the Peace Arch was organized by Mr. Siddiqui, and we'll talk with him about that as well. Jeff Siddiqui came to the United States in 1974 to earn a master's degree. He became a citizen in 1986. Since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, he said he has experienced incidents he believes occurred because of his religion, his name, or appearance. And we will be talking with Jeff Siddiqui about that in just a moment as he joins us this afternoon on Sound Living. And again, if you would like to join the conversation, write the telephone number down. It is 425-303-9070. That is our phone number. And if you would like to join us a little bit later, you are certainly welcome to do that as we talk about being a Muslim in a post-9/11 world, and particularly in a post-9/11 America. Jeff Siddiqui, 51 years old. He is a real estate agent in the area, and he has two children, and we will be talking to him about that as well. Just reading from his blog of July 23rd, I opened today's Seattle Times and their second headline regarding the Oslo bombing, Quote, officials say no link to terrorists, death toll attack could rise. He goes on to write in his blog, the anti-Muslim hysteria in the West has degenerated so far that a man who kills over 90 people has, quote, no link to terrorists, but a Muslim who tries to board a flight is already deemed a terrorist. Even if the headline came on a feed, the Seattle Times could use its own judgment and rewrite the same headlines as official says no link to organized terrorists, death toll attack could rise. He goes on to write in his blog, it appears that when it comes to Muslims, the Seattle Times could spare the extra thought to help not skew opinions against us. As a newspaper, I would have hoped that the conscience would be made well aware of the current anti-Muslim hysteria and the paper would be going out of its way to avoid promoting it. That is from the Jeff Siddiqui's blog of July 23rd. And again, his blog, if you would like to read it, is at penjihad.wordpress.com. We'll take a break. We'll take a look at that traffic because it is pretty miserable today. And in a moment, we will be joined here on Sound Living by Jeff Siddiqui. Our phone number, if you'd like to write it down, is 425-303-9070. And we're back on Sound Living this afternoon, and wonder of wonders, my guest has made it up from Linwood this afternoon. I guess traffic is miserable. Jeff Siddiqui, my guest, a Pakistani-American living in Linwood. He is also a Muslim and has experienced firsthand the hatred and fear and distrust of Muslims living in a post-9/11 world. And welcome to Sound Living this afternoon, Mr. Siddiqui.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me about the drive up. Apparently, it was pretty miserable.
I don't know what I'd rather face than this traffic. Northbound traffic is horrible. It's more like a parking lot. It's, man, it's bad.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and making the trek up here from Linwood this afternoon to join me on Sound Living this afternoon. And if anyone would like to join us, our phone number is 425-303-9070. If you'd like to check out Mr. Siddiqui's blog, it is penjihad.wordpress.com. If you'd like to check his blog before joining us this afternoon at 425-303-9070. Did you use a lot, or did you give a great deal of thought before you decided to use the word jihad as part of your blog address?
I was actually advised not to use it by my friends. They said, why do you want to use a charged word like that? And I said, it's not charged. It's no more charged than Christmas or let me put it to you, than the swastika.
Those are very charged
symbols. Of course they are, but the swastika is a holy symbol. It's been a holy symbol for over 10,000 years.
Although many would argue that the Nazis co-opted it.
They didn't co-opt it. They didn't co-opt it. They took it and they used it for their own evil purposes. But it still remains a holy symbol. It is used in Hindu practices and Hindu celebrations all the time. It very much is like the principle of use it or lose it. If you start saying that parts of what your holy traditions are in themselves evil, just because some evil people used it, then you're saying that your religion has more evil in it. I don't see that. I don't see why. Jihad is a very nice word. It means struggle. Struggle for justice, struggle for the betterment of society and betterment of the world.
But it too has been co-opted and corrupted.
Of course. Just like crusade has been used badly, Christianity has been used badly. You know, there are the abusers will use the best. Nobody will pick the bad words in a language and say, follow me because I'm going into the gutter. Everybody will say, I am the greatest peacemaker on God's earth, follow me, and they'll, you know, lead everyone to oblivion. So people will use and abuse good words. We should be careful to associate the evil with the people rather than with the traditions.
We're talking on Sound Living this afternoon with Jeff Siddiqui. If you'd like to join the conversation, it is 425-303-9070. Talk to me a little bit about living and being in this country before 9/11. Was anyone conscious of your religion? Was anyone conscious or concerned about you being a Pakistani? Any of that in existence before 9/11?
Yes, it was. But it was very much a subdued murmur, occasionally cropping up here and there. You would hear it, you would dismiss it, you would move on. Or you would take notice of it and address it. And you know, everybody would support the Muslims saying, hey, we're all human beings, we're all Americans, or we're all, you know, people of goodwill. After 9/11, it seemed as if everybody got a free, it was open season, everyone got a hunting ticket and let's go get them. It became a matter of patriotism and it became a holy thing to go chase the other, the identifiable other, which is the brown-skinned Muslim. And to our distress, our politicians, who could have stopped this at any time, even today, have chosen not to, because they want to be seen as being strong on tough on terrorism and real patriots, and like all scoundrels who hide behind words like that, they have chosen silence and support of the fanatics. You find this in other countries too. I mean, in Muslim majority countries, you find gutless politicians who allow religious fanatics to take over. In this country, you find gutless politicians who allow other fanatics to take over. Much of the same.
And you decided to be outspoken in public rather than what many might have argued had been the wiser course, to step back, to become as invisible as possible. was there an incident, or was it in your upbringing that motivated you towards being visible and outspoken, to the point of not only having your own blog, but to organize rallies as you did at the Peace Arch in Blaine and be as visible as you are?
The credit for this has to go to my mother. She never took a back seat to anybody. She would look at generals and prime ministers in the eye and tell them exactly what she thought of them, and never backed out. And she also taught me that what is right and what is just must be preserved. So I try to follow her steps in my own microscopic way. I'm sure I don't do her justice. But if there is a grievous injustice occurring, it doesn't matter. It happens right now that we are the main target, but it shouldn't matter. It doesn't matter who is being targeted, whether this is a 1940s, 50s, 60s America where the blacks are being targeted, or whether it's South Africa with white rule. Justice has to be served. And if we don't stand up for justice, very soon we will live in injustice. And it's not that if you allow this, what will happen to me later, because that's a consequence. You're driven by fear. You should be driven by what is right. This is right. It doesn't matter whether I suffer consequences or gain or nothing happens. I need to make a... Just think of all the major atrocities in history. What would have happened if people of goodwill had stood up and said, this has to stop? What about Hitler? What if Germany and Europe had stood up and said, you have to stop? Can you even imagine all these things? At every step, you see these horrors, and you just think at a certain point, if a few people had stood up, it would have stopped right there.
Do you feel lonely? Do you feel as if you are a focal point, for a target for the animosity and the anger and the hatred that has been created in this country by the media and by some of our leaders?
No, I don't. I think that would be elevating myself to a grand position that I don't deserve, at least not right now. Yes, there are some people who have aimed their bile at me, but in general, I don't feel that. I do feel a little bit like I'm leading a charge with no one following. But the idea is not to look for immediate victory and immediate results. The idea is to make people aware so that maybe somebody gets it. Maybe not right now, maybe next week, maybe next month.
We're talking on Sound Living this afternoon with Jeff Siddiqui, and if you'd like to join our conversation, it is 425-303-9070. And we're talking with Mr. Siddiqui about being a Muslim in a post-9/11 world, in a post-9/11 America. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it is 425-303-9070. Tell me a little bit more about your mother and about growing up in Pakistan, because Pakistan is one of those countries that has been made our enemy.
Yes, yes. Well, Pakistan is, you see, we like to create one image of somebody, anybody, whether it's our friend or it's our foe. We like to have a monolith impression of that entire society so that we can deal with that monolith impression and be done with it. Pakistan is not just a country with foaming, frothing fanatics, bug-eyed with a knife in their hands, and all women hiding in a corner, cowering behind their burqas and hijab. That's not Pakistan. There are people in Pakistan who are very conservative. Yes, there are villages in Pakistan where women do not move out alone. There are very patriarchal societies in Pakistan, but there are also very, very shall I say, egalitarian societies in a certain way. Pakistan has contradictions. The one time I feared for my life was when my aunt was driving me in her car from one place to another in Pakistan. And this woman was an aggressive driver. And she would lean out of her window and tell people what she thought of them. And I'm thinking, holy smokes.
Well, how old were you?
Oh, no, this is just a few years ago. Yeah. This is not a long time ago. Pakistan has always had this struggling contradiction. Pakistan had women in the army, generals in the army, before the United States had women in the army. Pakistan had women in Congress before the United States had them. In cabinet, even. And
where does that contradiction then come in, that the Muslim faith hides and protects its women and do not give women the rights, when now we have women? You're telling us that Pakistan had women in the army as generals even before we allowed women in our military.
Yes.
Where does that contradiction come from? Is it the Quran?
No. The Quran does not say women have to be relegated to the house, women have to be covered from head to toe, although the conservative Muslims will tell you that they're following God's commands by being conservative. I mean, it's essentially, if you look at, let's say, Judaism, you'll find similar things. You'll find the very conservative Jews whose women don't go out of the house and stay in, and you'll find the liberal Jews. Similarly with Christians and Muslims. We're really no different from anyone else, except that Pakistan is incredibly illiterate and poor. When you mix illiteracy, poverty, with fanaticism, you get very, very hidebound, closed-minded people. And yes, there are. We could start an export business with them. there are lots of free thinkers, although the trends in Pakistan right now are going towards more and more conservatism. That's because of the incredible corruption that stifles education opportunities, business opportunities, and people have very little to go to except God. And when an illiterate imam tells them this is what God is saying, they don't go to the Quran and read it and say, no, that's not what God is saying. And that's where you're getting what you're getting.
What about your family? Was your family what we might refer to in this country as a progressive? Were they a conservative family? Your upbringing, how did it correspond to other parts of Pakistan and families in Pakistan?
My family, in the strata of the upper class, if you say, were egalitarian, liberated, liberal, non-conservative people, as were almost all other people in that social strata. The social classes in Pakistan are very stratified because poverty drives them to that segregation, if you will. And so we were brought up fine. We were brought up not to think of women as inferior or anything, although boys were more prized and still are more prized because the tradition is this is where the line continues. And so, you know, there's a prominence given to the males.
Did you have sisters?
I do. I have two sisters and I have a brother.
And were your sisters educated? Were they allowed to go to school and then go on to higher education?
Yes. Both my sisters have a bachelor's degree in university, as does my brother, who has a master's as well. And my sisters, one of them came to the United States to get her bachelor's degree. She was a very, very advanced consultant with a shipping company.
See, there's that contradiction again, because we hear of the stories where the Taliban and other imams and Shiites deny girls education. They blow up schools because they're educating girls.
Okay. Taliban are different from Shia. Shia is just a sect. It's like, if you will, Protestant and Catholic. The Shia are quite broad-minded and very liberal and educated, but they have their conservatives as well. Taliban are the people who are just bloody-minded conservative people who feel that God has given them the divine right to interfere in everybody's life. They are an unfortunate product of the U.S.-Soviet war back in the late 1970s.
Yet they can interpret the same Quran as you to read that girls should not be educated, that it is a violation of the holy teachings of Allah to educate girls.
Now see, this is the beauty of it. Open the Quran and take a look at it, and you will not find the stuff that they are talking about. You will not find it, I guarantee that. But as with any document you have, people can misinterpret it to an egregious point. I mean, there were people who, until as recently as the 1980s in South Africa, were swearing that the white are subhuman and it is the divine duty of white men the black are subhuman and it is the divine duty of white men to guide them. And this is biblical edict. There were people, educated people, saying that. Taliban are sort of the same kind of corrupted conservative people. They're not even conservative. They're just corrupted people.
Yet they seem to be receiving the most attention.
Well, you know, when somebody's burning the house down, you tend to look at that person first. And they are. They are very, they get their as in any society, the loud mouths and the violent tend to lead the country, because the rest of us stay quiet. The rest of us let it happen as long as it's not happening to us.
What is it, do you think, that causes such animosity and fear from the Muslims and toward the Muslims? We had the incident in Norway where horrendous crime committed against the Muslims. Horrendous crimes are committed by Muslims. What is it, do you think, that generates such animosities?
Well, if I may step back for a moment, when you're looking for solutions with a hammer in your hand, you are only going to find nails. You're only going to be looking for nails. So to bring that to your question, it's not the Muslim thing. It's people who identify crimes as Muslim, and you just like in the pre-80s, I would say, if a crime was committed by a black guy, they made sure they called it as a black guy committing a crime. If a crime was committed by a white man, they didn't mention his race, and so the idea that got embedded in society is black people are all criminals. rapists, you know, murderers. Similarly here, you find a lot of violence, and you find the Muslim examples, you bring that up to the very top. For example, I'll give you some examples. Some of the greatest acts of terrorism in the United States after 9/11 were being planned and were almost perpetrated by non-Muslims. People with cyanide bombs ready, 18 cyanide bombs ready to be deployed, each cyanide bomb capable of killing everyone in a shopping center, in a shopping mall. People trying to smuggle ground-to-air missiles for attack against civilian aircraft. People who had enough explosives in California to, in the words of the FBI, to flatten a city block. Same thing, people in Florida to flatten a city block. Each one of these had lists of institutions they were ready to blow up.
And we shouldn't forget Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh was way before. I'm talking after 9/11. In fact, the biggest cache of explosives found in a house in the history of the United States was in California recently. So there are these things, but we don't point out to them. We don't look for them. We don't point it out as something Christians are doing or something Jews are doing or something somebody else is doing. But if a Muslim is caught with, six Muslims are caught playing paintball in Pennsylvania, they say these guys were practicing to do the real thing in India and Pakistan against people, civilians and innocent, and they make a huge federal case out of it. Paintball.
You write about similar to that in your blog on the 23rd, when you took on the Times for its headlines regarding the Oslo bombing, and official says no link to terrorists, rather than, as you suggest, organized terrorists.
Yes, because today in the lexicon, terrorism has become synonymous with Islam and Muslims. You say terrorist, and the first picture, even in the mind of a Muslim, the first picture comes up as a Muslim. That's how the culture has. Now, I'll tell you, being here has created certain imagery that even we as Muslims, who are on the receiving end of the imagery, can't shake off. I'll tell you, just a few years ago, I went to Pakistan. I went there in December. And I thought, well, I'm going in December and I'll meet friends and family and come back. I went there and I called my uncle. He's my favorite uncle. I'm his favorite nephew. I say, hey, I'm in town. He said, oh, this is fantastic. I haven't seen you in 10 years. Well, I said, how about meeting today? He said, no, I can't. I'm going to a friend's Christmas party. I said, well, how about tomorrow? I'm going to another friend's Christmas party. And I thought to myself, for God's sake, I've been gone for 10 years. And so I'm driving down this road, and I see a huge four-tier cake. I mean, this was like a diameter of maybe 10 feet at the base. It was, you know, a model. And the sign up there saying, last chance to order your Christmas cakes right now or you'll lose it. I went into a shopping center. And one thing when I left here, I have to admit, after hearing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer for the 156th time in 3 days, and, you know, Santa Claus and all that, I was sick of it. I don't mind that once in a while, but man, they really pour it into you in that period. So I thought to myself when I left, I said, you know what, I won't miss this at all. I walk into a shopping center and I hear Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
And this is in Pakistan.
In Pakistan. I'm thinking, God. Now, I'm telling you these things because sitting here, I never expected to come across these things over there. I thought it would be an intolerant society, no tolerance for Christians. Muslims would be completely segregated from Christians. And I go there and I see that everybody is enjoying the festivities. So a lot of the imagery is right here. What we hear are the cases of people blowing each other up rather than the cases of the wonderful example of the people over there.
We're talking on Sound Living this afternoon with Jeff Siddiqui. If you'd like to join the conversation, 425-303-9070. We're going to take another quick break for a look at the traffic and the weather on this Friday afternoon, and then we will continue with our conversation this afternoon on Sound Living. Stay with us. And we are back on Sound Living this afternoon. Our guest is Jeff Siddiqui, an American Muslim. He is a Muslim living in America in a post 9/11 world, and we are talking with him about that. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have your questions, please feel free to call us at 425-303-9070. I don't think Jeff is a traditional Muslim name, is it?
No. My real name is Jaffer.
And did you make it Jeff? Did Americans make it Jeff because they couldn't pronounce Jafar?
Funnily enough, I was a kid in Pakistan, and we used to play, of all things, cowboys and Indians. And some of my friends decided to start calling me Jeff. And I never shook it off.
Dangerous to play Indian in Pakistan.
Yeah, well, Pakistanis are different from Indians. We like to think so.
Well, you have two children.
Yes.
What age are they?
My daughter is going on 22. She will be 22 this year, I think. I know. And she's studying at Western. My son is in high school, and he's 18.
Were there difficulties raising American kids as Muslims?
Well, my wife is not Muslim. She's a white American. We live in a very, I would say, free-thinking or non-conservative, laid-back, sort of life. And so we don't have those kinds of clashes and problems.
And so you as a Muslim did not command that your children follow the same religion as you?
I don't think faith can be commanded. I think if you force faith at some point, the person will rebel and pop out. I think faith is something that comes from your inner soul, and it takes you where you might not think you were going at all.
And how is your 18-year-old son, how did he deal with being a Muslim in a post 9/11 world at 14, 15, 16 years old?
Well, right now he's in his rebellious stage, but I'll tell you, right after 9/11, on the first anniversary of 9/11, he was about... I think 7, 8 years old. And the teacher gave every kid a 11-by-17 sheet of paper, butcher paper, and said, draw the American flag on it. And, you know, kids, they drew the American flag on it. And at the end of the day, the teacher pulled me aside and said, I'd like to show you what your son did. And he showed me the flag which my son had drawn. And the teacher had asked every kid to write on each stripe the first word that comes to their mind when they think of America. And the first word my 7 or 8 year old son thought of was afraid. Hmm. Even today when I think about it, it just shakes me to my bones. You know, he's too young to know what really was happening, but he was not too young to hear conversations. And no child should be brought up in a society of that kind of oppression.
And how does he feel and your daughter feel about the visibility that you've given yourself in the last 10 years?
I think they're okay with it, although, as I said, my son is in his rebellious stage, so he's deeply embarrassed by everything the old man ever thinks or does. my daughter is all for it. My wife is perpetually afraid that somebody is going to come and do something to us.
You are not afraid?
You know, you can't live in fear all your life. You have to be cautious at times, but to live in fear is a terrible thing. And you can't expect to change things or to help society move in a better area if you yourself are paralyzed with fear or overcome with fear.
So. Is this a particularly difficult time for you being Ramadan, and your lifestyle changes radically and more publicly?
I would love a long, cool glass of water right now, I'll tell you. But I can't. I'm fasting. Mm-hmm. And it does change. I found myself, as I was heading north in the traffic jam today, momentarily switching into an angry driver and then telling myself, no, you can't do that. You're fasting. And kind of let go and say, well, you know, I'll get there. Not getting there any faster by getting grumpy. And just taking a deep breath and saying, I'm fasting, I'm not allowed. And it's a very liberating feeling if you get used to it, once you get used to it.
It's interesting because you write on your blog about Ramadan, and what we as non-Muslims are told is that 1 month out of the year you cannot eat from sunrise to sunset. Mm-hmm. Your blog goes into more detail and forgive me if I insult you by putting it in Judeo-Christian terms.
Not at all. Not at all.
It's more like us wishing that the Christmas spirit would last 12 months.
Yes.
Because you go into more detail about how the whole process is supposed to remind you to be a better person.
It is. You see, in religion, there is the ritual and there is the spiritual. And unfortunately, no matter what religion we're in, we follow the ritual and we think we've done God's will and we walk away very proud of ourselves for being good Christian, good Jew, good Muslim. The fact is, without the spiritual, the ritual is an empty shell. It has nothing in it. Even the 5 times a day prayer in Islam, it's not so that there is an egotistic God who says, you must bow to me and tell me what a great guy I am. What? Tell me again. I can't hear you. That's not God. The message behind praying 5 times a day at given times, so you have to stop whatever you're doing and pray, is that you should center yourself at that time, 5 times a day, and remind yourself what God sent you on the earth for, to leave a better footprint, leave a better earth behind you, to step lightly, to help your humanity, to make your neighborhood better, to help your country become better, to make yourself better. These are the commands in the Quran as they are in the Bible and the Torah. But it helps remind you. If all you're doing is praying or going hungry for the day and thinking you've been a great Muslim, you've not done anything. And in Islam, we don't have grace that if you're a Muslim, you're going to go to heaven no matter what. We are going to be judged by our actions.
I thought that if you killed an infidel, you automatically went to heaven.
Oh, well, some people might like to think that, but that's not true either. And what is an infidel? Anybody who believes in one God is a Muslim in the sense of Islam. It says in the Quran, anybody who believes in God, anybody who's had a revelation, they are Muslims.
Well, who is it that is teaching these people that if they blow themselves up, they are going to go to heaven and they will be martyrs because they killed? Who is it that is teaching them that?
The concept of martyrhood is a long one, and it's present in every faith. The concept that if you die in the defense of your faith and your values and your family, God is going to grant you heaven. That concept exists. That concept is very much there. Now, what is dying for your family? Is it putting on a shrapnel-filled vest and blowing myself up and killing a whole bunch of innocent people? Is that? That's not martyrdom. That's not defending your country or your people or your faith. But you have very impressionable kids who have no knowledge of faith meeting a very evil-minded, bloody-minded person who is respected for his leadership. Faith leadership, if you will. He tells you what martyrdom is and how Islam needs to be protected and all that. And these people are very impressionable. At that age, they are. It's sort of like recruitment to a Nazi camp or recruitment to a kamikaze pilot center. You tell them they're defending the country, they'll go defend the country. That's the problem. We have illiteracy, and we have people who don't know the faith who are being told what the faith is. I mean, go back to the 1970s and 80s when the U.S. and the Soviet Union were fighting in Afghanistan, where the Taliban, pre-Taliban, were born. The U.S. funded madrasas in Pakistan over the protests of the more rational people in Pakistan who said...
Define that term.
Schools. Religious schools, who said, don't do this because you will be gone and these people will be left behind. And the U.S. said, shut up, and poured more money, and the general said, shut up, and took the money. But these religious schools, the madrasas, created fanatical people. They took the children from the Afghan camps. They took them and put them in madrasas, and they taught them that God is the only one you should be thinking of, that the infidel, because in those days the communists were the infidel, the infidel must be killed because he's attacking our faith and attacking our land and killing our people. And this is a great thing you're doing for Islam, so go get him, boy. And when these children grew up in the next few years, they were moved from the madrasas to Mujahideen training camps. They were given sophisticated weapons and they were sent into Afghanistan. And they did the job they were sent to do very well. Soviet Union had to leave. Unfortunately, the Soviet Union had not quite shut their door as they left Afghanistan when the United States was already gone. They didn't get into any reconstruction or education or anything. Here they were, these fully armed killing machines. All they knew was fanatical interpretation of religion and killing. And they took over. And of course, what is one to expect than what we got?
Is it your faith and your interpretation of your faith that gives you the power to be as calm and thoughtful in discussing this as you are? Here you are, a man who is, I'm sure, goes through extra security scrutiny at airports. You write about how you were confronted when you came out of a bathroom on a flight because the stewards and the crew or the passengers thought maybe you spent too much time in there. You should be angry.
I am angry.
But you don't demonstrate that anger by strapping a bomb on your chest and blowing somebody up. You channel it in a different direction.
Yeah, but that would hurt. I'm not going to change anybody's mind by spitting in their face or punching them in the eye or raving and ranting. I'm not looking to vent my spleen and to satisfy my ego that I have, you know, told them what I think of them. That doesn't get us anywhere. My idea of a great day is to meet a whole bunch of people who hate my guts and talk to them. My idea of victory from there is if I can plant one tiny seed in one person among those hundreds of people, so that maybe a week or a month or 2 months later, the seed starts sprouting and he says, you know what, maybe what this guy said has something to consider. That's all I'm looking for. I'm not looking for epiphanies or hallelujahs or anything like that. And it does happen every once in a while. And it's wonderful to hear feedback when that happens. And that's the only way for what I would call a lasting victory for justice. Otherwise, all we're doing is a cycle of anger, venting anger. That gets us nowhere.
And Ramadan is a period of time that gives you the opportunity to reflect on that, call it a mission, if we will?
Yes, it does. But the reflection, unfortunately, is not limited to Ramadan. It's just, it's on a daily basis. The buffeting we get is not, I'm not as concerned about the Joe citizen or the Joe Sixpack who takes a bash at me or swears at me, that is a passing phase. If somebody gets up right now and hits me in the face, yes, it'll hurt, and yes, it'll be sore for a few days, but I'll be okay after a while. Maybe, you know, one hopes. But it's the brainwashing of a whole society that is going to last for a generation or two generations or three generations that's going on right now, being funded and promoted at all levels from our government, that scares the daylights out of me. We have the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and the military being trained, actively trained, to consider that Islam and Muslims are the greatest threat to the West and to America. And that our single goal is to destroy Western civilization. That is being trained, part of the training program, with so-called self-styled experts who come in there, and they're being paid millions of dollars to do this on a daily basis to our police, our FBI, our military.
And do you find yourself looking over your shoulder when a police car drives by in Everett or in Seattle or wherever you happen to be?
No, but I'll tell you, if I'm ever stopped by a police officer or I see an FBI agent, my blood does run cold. I'm worried about what they're going to do, what they're thinking. I don't want them to think that they are looking at the worst killer since I don't know, the Green River Killer, and that if they don't shoot me first, I'll shoot them. Because that is the kind of training they've been given.
So how did you respond to the journalist who lost his job because he said on public television that he has concerns when he sees a Muslim getting on his airplane?
What was his name? I forget.
I've been trying to think.
Oh, gosh, I'm having a memory blank.
Yeah,
I forget
so
his
have
name.
I. So
but
have
anyway,
I.
That man himself said several years earlier, when there was a case where a jewelry store would not let a black man in their store when he wanted to come in, and the guy said no. This journalist was still a journalist, a young one at that time, and he wrote an editorial saying even the thought that this kind of, that you're thinking that this person is associated with crime is racism, and it should be condemned. Now, this is the same man who comes around and says when he sees a Muslim, he wonders, he fears, and then he expects us to think that he is above racism. I don't think so. I think we should apply his own standards. Maybe he shouldn't have been fired. Maybe he should. I wasn't there. But yes, he is absolutely a hypocrite and a bigot.
At sundown tonight, what will you be doing?
Well, first I have to have a glass of water, and then I'd have a date, which is traditional way to break the fast. And then you pray and you thank God for having been given the patience to go through the day. And people usually pray for the people who are hungry and thirsty involuntarily, who are suffering hunger and thirst because there is no food or water, whereas we are doing it voluntarily. And we pray that God would alleviate their problems. And we pray for a blessing for people around us. And then we start eating some more. But you can't pack it in. You have to leave space in the stomach, because the idea is not to pack it in and then think you're fasting.
Mr. Siddiqui, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me.
I very much enjoy talking with you. My guest has been Jeff Siddiqui, Pakistani-American, who is outspoken in his criticism of the anti-Muslim attitudes and fears in this country in this post-9/11 era. And you can read his blog at penjihad.wordpress.com. Next week on Sound Living, my guest will be Everett's new chief of police, Kathy Atwood. She is the first woman to hold that position and is one of only about 200 women police chiefs in the country. And we invite you to join the conversation next week on Sound Living with the new Chief of Police for Everett, Kathy Atwood. And again, thank you for joining me today on Sound Living.
Delighted. Thank you.